This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
As president, I'll end Obama's war on religion, and I'll fight against liberal attacks on our religious heritage.
Rick Perry, you've got to be kidding me. Is this what it's come to? A serious presidential candidate attacking the sitting president as waging a war on religion? Never afraid to charge into some of the odder places in today's political landscape, Religion Dispatch's senior editor Sarah Posner will join us with an update on the reality TV show that the 2012 presidential campaign has become. In recent years, it has become somewhat fashionable to challenge oneself to some radical program of self-improvement, exploration, or change, and then to write a book about the experience. The challenge represented in the book, Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor, is, I think, ambitious enough. And fortunately for us, the telling of the story is just as worthy of attention as is the story itself. We're going to meet the author of Flunking Sainthood, Jana Reese, on this week's edition of State of Belief Radio. But first,
from holiday trees in Rhode Island to Santa being banned from schools in Fort Worth, Texas, the war on Christmas is heating up.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has raised the hackles of some atheists by calling a Christmas tree a Christmas tree.
Lawmakers voted to call this a Christmas tree, but the governor calls it a holiday tree.
I have my own religious views, but as a government official, I want to keep it separate.
Our heritage is under attack by a mass media and a government that is determined to wipe out our precious heritage. There is no better example than the war being waged on Christmas.
For right-wing propagandists, Christmas is the season for giving that just keeps on giving. Year after year, conservative voices in the media construct a narrative that accuses liberal, secular, un-American forces of conspiring to wage a so-called war on Christmas. Look, it's easy to spoof the simple-minded faith baiting that pops up every year at this time, but one writer suggests that, in fact, there is too much Christ in the Christmas we celebrate today. Amy Sullivan has written a provocative article for USA Today that argues that what we should be doing is taking the Christ out of Christmas. And I am really happy to have her joining us in the studio. Amy, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be here.
And explain yourself, if you will.
Well, it may sound kind of counterintuitive to take Christ out of Christmas, but as a Christian, I've been struck, particularly over the last few decades, that there's not a lot of religious sentiment to the Christmas that we all celebrate. Whenever right-wingers kind of go after commercial merchandisers for not saying Christmas and instead putting up Happy Holidays banners, I'm always wondering what version of Christianity they are trying to represent, because in my version, Christmas is not about buying reduced price waffle makers or even having a store clerk wish me Merry Christmas. When somebody says Merry Christmas, they're generally just mean have a good festive season, not, you know, enjoy your celebration of Christ's birth.
Yeah. The whole history of Christmas, as I understand it, involves a celebration that had to be worked into a work schedule, and it wasn't about all of the accoutrements that we think about. There were diversions everywhere.
Well, certainly Christmas, as we understand it now, is a pretty modern, recent development. But you're right that from the very beginning, it was folded into pre-existing midwinter celebrations, partly as a way of making it easier and maybe more palatable for the Roman Empire to, in its conversion to Christianity, celebrate the birth of Christ. There were pre-existing Roman celebrations every year around the New Year, and they involved gift-giving and merriment and feasts and a lot of the things that we use to celebrate the holiday season now. But also in northern countries, it was just a way to get through the winter. There were a lot of cultures that had a lot of the elements we think of. They included use of candlelight or fires just to kind of light up their lives in a time when darkness was prevalent. Use of greenery long before the Christmas tree came around. People would use boughs of fir or whatever sort of greenery was around to remind them that winter would eventually end. And so Christmas, which wasn't actually celebrated until the 4th century, was kind of folded into these pre-existing traditions that a lot of cultures had. And it explains why even today we have kind of two parallel tracks of Christmas celebration. We have one that's this more kind of wide open, festive. It's a chance to give gifts to people in your lives. It's a chance to hold Christmas parties, to sing songs, to just be merry. And then we have ever fewer people who actually go to church on Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's become a big, almost cultural tradition right. to go to Christmas Eve services. But it, again, that's almost more cultural than it is religious at this point. And the actual celebration of the day of Christmas as a religious holiday is limited to a minority at this point.
Well, I'm fascinated with your proposal. You're saying, why don't we have a Jesus Day to mark the birth of Christ and leave the end of the year festivities, the gift giving, and all of that secular part of these days called Xmas? There is a real heartfelt poignancy to the way you describe what Jesus Day would mean. And I wish you would talk about it, because I think our listeners will be fascinated.
Sure. Well, on the one hand, I just want us to acknowledge what is basically the reality today, which is that we do have this secular festive Christmas season that has almost nothing to do with religion. We sing popular songs like We Wish You a Merry Christmas, Deck the Halls, Jingle Bells. These are all about the cultural celebration of Christmas. They're all about being with family, which is an important value, but it's not the religious meaning of the holiday. And so for me, I go back to how we celebrated Christmas when I was a child. I grew up in the Baptist church, and my Baptist grandmother would bake a birthday cake for baby Jesus that we would stand around on Christmas Day. We would sing happy birthday to baby Jesus. And it was an acknowledgement, even though we opened gifts and had a Christmas tree, we were not deprived as children. But it was an acknowledgement of why we were recognizing that day. We would go to church services on Christmas Day, and there might not have been many people, but those who were there would, again, gather together, and we had a great song called Happy Birthday, Baby Jesus, and everybody would get in the spirit by singing that. And it was a focus on the birth of Jesus, which by the time we get to Christmas morning in our recent years, people are exhausted. They have no energy left to focus on the actual day of Christmas.
Yeah. That does leave open the possibility for other religious traditions to participate in gift giving, those kinds of things, without it reflecting on any kind of commitment of Christ's birth or the recognition of any significance of that. Was that true?
Absolutely, yeah. In addition to kind of setting aside the actual birth of Christ as Jesus Day, which I feel would allow those of us who have serious Christian commitments to really focus on our holiday, I think the beauty of this is that it does make the festive season open to everybody. Even Santa Claus hold religious connotations for religious minorities who feel excluded and who really shouldn't, because this is a very secular cultural celebration.
What are some of the things we could do right now to help people distinguish between the cultural dimensions and the spiritual dimensions?
That's a good question. There are two things that are going on. One is kind of a backlash to the commercialization of Christmas, which you see in movements like the Advent Conspiracy, mm-hmm. which is people who are saying, enough. There's too much focus on buying things, and especially at a time when people don't have as much money, when economic times are much harder. We need to take away the focus on accumulation of stuff and allow us either to focus on the religious significance, have more of a mindfulness for the Advent season, which gets lost for a lot of people, but also to focus on giving to others. So for the Advent Conspiracy, for example, people try to challenge themselves to give less, but then spend part of what they're saving on a cause like Living Water International to mm-hmm. help dig wells for people in developing countries who don't have clean water. That type of focus may seem to people beside the point when it comes to Christmas, but that's because we've so perverted the idea mm-hmm. of Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need those religious conservatives who have so fueled the war on Christmas to pull back and to recognize that they're fighting the wrong fight here.
Amy Sullivan is a contributing writer at Time magazine and author of The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap. Her article, Let's Put Christmas in Its Place, appeared this last week in USA Today. I encourage you to look it up if you didn't see it on the day it was published. I think you'll benefit from pondering it. Amy, thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
We've got to take a short break, but coming right up, poor Sarah Posner will be here to calm me down about Rick Perry's Obama's War on Religion campaign ad, about the Donald Trump debate, and other disturbing developments in this reality TV show of a presidential campaign season. And later in State of Belief today, Jana Reese, author of the book Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Whether it's Rick Perry's The Response Revival outrageously conflating government and religion earlier this year, or the Values Voters Summit with far-right religious leaders and far-right political figures desperate to tear down the constitutional wall separating church and state, Religion Dispatch's senior editor Sarah Posner unwaveringly parachutes in and lives to write about it. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me again, Welton.
Now, Sarah, before you get started today, and I'm a little bit sorry for having to do this, but I've got to ask you about your religious identity before I can interview you today.
What?
No. I'm not going to do that. I'm just really fired up about this Rick Perry campaign ad. I first want to play just a little bit of what Perry said.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm a Christian. But you don't need to be in the pew every Sunday to know that there's something wrong in this country when gays can serve openly in the military, but our kids can't openly celebrate Christmas or pray in school.
Now, Sarah, what on earth is the Perry campaign doing?
Well, I think it knows exactly what it is doing. It is trying to tap into the most fervent part of the Republican base, that part of the base that still believes that there's a war on Christmas and that gay rights equals an infringement of their religious liberty, sort of the same argument, the argument he was trying to touch on with the comment about gays serving in the military. And I think he was also trying to goad the Democrats into talking the faith talk more. The Democrats don't have to answer to Republican charges that they are engaged in a war on religion or they're hostile to religion or President Obama doesn't talk about his faith enough. And I think that Democrats should just ignore this ad by Rick Perry. He's still polling in single digits. And it seems like this ad was intentionally designed to get a rise out of people when, in fact, we should probably just ignore it.
Oh, boy. Then I played into his hands because he certainly got me upset. I want to play you another part of the Rick Perry ad before we leave this alone.
As president, I'll end Obama's war on religion, and I'll fight against liberal attacks on our religious heritage.
Now, Sarah, if this actually attracts Iowa caucus goers, then it feels like us, people who care about the First Amendment to the Constitution and believe it's important, are close to losing the battle.
Well, it's long been a myth that Democrats don't talk about their religion enough on the campaign trail. They aren't friendly to religion. I mean, this was a myth about why John Kerry lost to George W. Bush in 2004. So in 2006, the Democrats tried to talk about their faith more. Obama had a religious outreach, a fairly robust religious outreach in his presidential campaign in 2008. He revived the faith-based office. He's ignored requests by church-state separation advocates to reform the office to be more in compliance with the Constitution. So sure, Democrats have reacted to this mythology that they're hostile to religion, and that's at the urging of Democratic strategists, which I think is a mistake because it takes Democrats down a path of blurring the lines between church and state. And it also plays into Republican hands about something that isn't even true. I mean, Democrats aren't hostile to religion just because they don't adhere to the Republican concept of Christian American exceptionalism. So, you know, Perry's trying to tap into that. I think he's also trying to tap into some things that the Republicans are doing off the campaign trail. For instance, efforts by Republicans like Daryl Issa, who heads the House Committee on Oversight, to portray the Department of Health and Human Services' denial of a grant to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops as something that is amounts to religious discrimination. So Perry's tapping into both of those things, but I think it's also a little sign of his desperation given his poll numbers. I want to just say one more thing on the Perry ad. Newt Gingrich doesn't really have a very different position than Perry on this religious liberty and the melding of church and state. So to the extent that Perry is trying to dig into Gingrich's lead, I don't think that that ad will help him very much from a Republican perspective, because Gingrich is well known for his advocacy against the separation of church and state.
I certainly want to talk about Newt Gingrich, and we'll do that in just a minute. We've got to take a quick break. I don't think either one of us is going to calm down during the time, but we'll see. My guest is Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. We'll be right back. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. With us is Religion Dispatch's senior editor, Sarah Posner, who always brings insight to the issues of religion and politics, and never more so than during an electoral campaign. There's one more thing, though, that I want to ask you about, Perry. You published a long report on the governor and reproductive rights in Texas not long ago at Religion Dispatches. What do we need to know about that?
Perry is very admired by the anti-choice movement in Texas and nationally, but it doesn't seem to be making a difference for him in the presidential campaign. And that's largely because I think the anti-choice movement sees all of the candidates as pretty much being on their side, even though they definitely see Perry as a very strong advocate for their cause. I think they're more interested in having the strongest candidate to beat Obama as opposed to their most beloved candidate on pushing their legislative initiative, initiatives.
Sarah, the spotlight's certainly turned on Newt Gingrich, who's chosen to be provocative by repeatedly speaking in favor of putting poor children to work. He's been wearing a smug kind of I can't lose grin lately. Am I right, or is that just his natural expression?
I think that's his natural expression, but I also think he's feeling pretty good right now, and the polling data is really on his side. I think that Republicans are anxious to settle on the anti-Perry after taking a look at Bachman and then Perry and then Herman Cain. I think that they're anxious to get this thing settled, and he seems to them like the best alternative. That's not to say there aren't Republicans who are completely dismayed that he might be their nominee, but I think if he's looking at the polling data, he probably has some reason to feel a little smug.
But how is he going to do with evangelicals who turned out 60% of the Republican caucus vote in Iowa 4 years ago?
It's really interesting because I think that there's a contingent of evangelicals who feel that he hasn't sufficiently repented, not just for his marital infidelity and his multiple divorces and affairs and so forth, but they also see him as not being trustworthy politically, that he risked compromising the entire conservative cause when he was leading the charge for impeachment of President Clinton back in the 90s, but himself was carrying on an extramarital affair. And so they see him, it's not just the affair itself, but the circumstances under which he carried it on and the political risk that he put the entire party and the entire movement in as a result of that. I think that there's a fairly strong contingent of insidery type evangelicals, people like Marvin Olasky, who's written about this at World Magazine and gave a lengthy interview to National Review.
A compassionate conservative. That's who he is.
Yes.
That's where that term came from. He gave it to George W. Bush.
That's right. But he's also, you know, a fairly influential thinker among evangelicals and conservatives. He's helped the Heritage Foundation draft white papers on what social justice should look like to conservatives and so forth. But at the same time, I think that there are a lot of evangelicals who are getting ready to forgive Newt. They like the idea of having someone they see as a smarty pants debate Obama in the general election. They don't think that Rick Perry could pull that off, even though they like Rick Perry's positions on all of their issues. And so I think that there's starting to be a consensus among evangelicals that this is probably the best choice. I'm talking about elite evangelicals, and that's probably trickling down a little bit to the grassroots. Still, something could happen. This has been an unpredictable campaign. So, you know, we still have a little less than a month till the Iowa caucuses. And also winning the Iowa caucuses doesn't guarantee making it all the way to the nomination.
Right. Well, I was in Iowa last week, and one of the things that not a lot of people knew that much about was a secretive evangelical group, as reported on CNN and elsewhere, that is said to be working to ensure Mitt Romney's campaign fails. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I don't know that it's an official group, but there are reported to be some evangelicals who have gotten together to try to put the kibosh on Romney's campaign. And it's possible, you know, it's entirely possible that they don't even need to do that, given how Romney is perceived, particularly in Iowa, where he really hasn't campaigned that much. But I think that overall, I mean, I think there is this rift in the conservative movement, including among conservative evangelicals, over Romney. And that there's a strong enough distrust of Romney for a variety of reasons. The Mormon thing is part of it, but it's also his lack of sincerity in their view on the issues that matter to them, his what they call flip-flopping on gay marriage and abortion. So he has a lot of deficits for them. And I think that regardless of whether this secret group actually exists or actually has any power to bring down Romney in the Iowa caucuses, these are problems he's going to have to face in any state that has a big evangelical population.
Sarah, as usual, when we talk, the frustration is mounting in me because we're running out of time, and I've got far more questions to ask you than we have time for you to answer. So do you want to talk about Ron Paul, who you've written about lately, or do you want to talk about Donald Trump?
Well, we can talk about both.
Okay, have at it.
Well, Ron Paul is the one candidate, aside from John Huntsman, who's definitively said no to the Donald Trump debate in Iowa at the last week of December between Christmas and New Year's. And, you know, so for Ron Paul to be making some sort of sense is saying that having Trump host this debate is beneath the dignity of the office of the president. Sort of an interesting development. But it appears that the heavyweights in the conservative movement are lining up behind the Trump debate that includes Americans for Tax Reform, the American Conservative Union, Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition is making noises about getting behind it. So Ron Paul has his followers who will love him for rejecting Trump, but he may be possibly missing out on the spectacle that other conservatives are getting behind.
Sir, I'm also glad you want to talk about Trump a little bit, because I've got to know, is he one of the seven horsemen of the apocalypse? Or is he just one more sign that our political system has been terminally infected by a media-driven obsession with celebrity? Or, I'm sure you know, what is it?
It's that I wrote earlier this week that he's like their new televangelist. The view that, you know, you don't question me, I'm the rich one and you're the loser, so you should listen to what I have to say on all these matters.
Okay, in the middle of all this now, I want to challenge you to talk about one actual policy issue that's managed to sneak into the campaign.
Well, they're talking about immigration. It is an actual policy issue. They're using it as a wedge issue, but immigration reform is a serious policy concern. It's just too bad that the Republicans are looking at it as a way to divide Americans.
Is what Obama did this past week in tying foreign aid to recipient nations' treatment of sexual minorities, I know that was a brave act. I thought Hillary Clinton's statement was one of the best speeches I've ever heard her make. But did that have anything to do with the campaign, or is that just a principle the president was willing to enunciate despite the conservative backlash?
Well, I think he's trying to play those sorts of issues both ways. He might do one thing, notwithstanding conservative backlash, and he might do another thing that is intended to quell conservative backlash, like the decision to override the Food and Drug Administration on the Plan B emergency contraception.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, that's very Obama to, pardon the pun in this circumstance, split the baby.
Sarah Poser is senior editor at Religion Dispatches, where she covers religion and politics. She's the author of the book God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S. That's why she knows so much about Donald Trump. Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Her work has also appeared in The Nation, Salon, The Guardian, The Daily Beast, and other publications. Sarah, it is always good to have you here. You give us insights. You give us fun. Thanks for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
We've got to take a quick break, friends, but please stay tuned. The author of the book, Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor, Jana Reese, will be joining us next on State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Sometimes an interview on the show requires a long and elaborate introduction to set up the topic and explain why we're addressing it on State of Belief Radio. But not this one. Once you hear the title of Jana Reese's new book, I think you'll understand why she's with us this week. Are you ready? Flunking Sainthood. A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. Yeah, I think in this rare instance, you can judge a book by its cover. And I want you to meet the author. Dr. Reese, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
What in the world moved you to write this insightful but also entertaining book? And I guess maybe before that, what moved you to try for sainthood in the first place?
Well, thank you for the compliment about the book. That is very kind. I think that I should tell you that I did not intend to set out to write a book about failure. I intended to write a book about reading spiritual classics and trying to do different spiritual practices. I didn't really think that I would fail at everything. So I tried 12 different spiritual practices, and to one degree or another, I failed at all of them.
What did you find to be the most difficult of those practices in your quest for sainthood?
Well, I was very surprised to find that the most difficult practice for me was gratitude. I had thought that gratitude would be one of the easiest things. I call it the expected bunny course in the book. And part of my practice that month was to write a letter every day to someone whose life had meant something very significant for me or who had done me a wonderful favor. And then also to keep a gratitude journal and just write five things every day that I was grateful for. And mm-hmm. I did those things. But I realized how difficult it is to sustain gratitude over time. And, you know, as we're all about to sit down for Thanksgiving dinner and all of that, this is on my mind quite a bit, that gratitude every day is such an important practice for everyone. And yet it's also surprisingly hard to do.
Hmm. Well, I'm curious. I was going to ask you the question, if there was a particular one of these 12 spiritual practices you attempted that was especially valuable to you, whether in success or otherwise, was that gratitude or was that something else?
You know, my favorite of the practices was in June. I tried one practice called centering prayer, mm-hmm. which is a really deep contemplative practice. And boy, it did not go well for me. I found out I have monkey mind. You know, I'm always thinking, what do I need from the grocery store? It's hard for me to sit down and just meditate. And I think a lot of people are probably like that. Mm-hmm. So that's the only one of the practices that I gave up midway through the month. And I was looking for another prayer practice that I could incorporate into my life and hit upon the Jesus Prayer, which is a prayer that comes from Eastern Orthodoxy. It is only 12 words long. And I figured, hey, even I can do 12 words. And so I would find ways to incorporate that prayer into my daily life. And it's one of the only practices that I'm still doing 2 years after this experiment.
About that. You know, I've always heard, and you may very well have come across this as well, I've always heard that a real saint is the person who lives with someone who thinks he's one.
That's excellent. That is great. And it's probably very true.
So,
my husband is a saint, but he doesn't think he is. So that's
All right. Well, then that's different. Jan, what did you learn about yourself during this process?
Well, I learned that failure is just as important a part of the authentic spiritual journey as any kind of success. You know, humility and gratitude, these are values that we need. And listening, you know, listening to what is happening to us, listening to the people around us and to their needs. Those are the things that are lasting and significant. At the end of this process, you know, I spent 2009 doing these spiritual practices and most of 2010 writing the book. And after I had turned in the manuscript for the book, I got a very unexpected phone call from Alabama that the father I had not seen or heard from in 26 years was dying in a mm-hmm. hospital, and I was listed as his only next of kin. So that completely unexpected experience changed my perspective on the spiritual practices that I thought had been such failures, because from somewhere I was able to pull up the ability to forgive him, and I don't know that I would have mm-hmm. been able to do that without some of these practices, such as the Jesus Prayer, or regularly saying the Lord's Prayer, reminding myself, you know, forgive us for our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Saying that every day changes a person, you know, reminding me that it's not my job to judge others, even those who have hurt me.
We could talk the rest of the afternoon about that, but my producer just fell out of his chair when I said that. The truth is, though, that there is something about the discipline in spirituality that even if you don't think it's nurturing you, it is in a way. Do you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. And I think that the beauty of spiritual practice is that it forges you almost unawares. You know, the main idea is that you show up. The main thing is that you continue trying, even when maybe you're in a dry spell, or even mm-hmm. when it feels like God is very distant, it's still important to try to maintain those connections.
I tell you what, anybody that cites the classic religious literature that you cite and also has such a great sense of humor has to be a very spiritual person.
Well, thank you. Humor is such an important part of the spiritual life. You know, I could not be on this journey without humor about my own failures, about religion in general. You know, it's so important that we maintain that ability to laugh at ourselves.
Jana Reese is the author of the new book, Flunking Sainthood, every one of us ought to identify with that title, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. I've got a son that would say, I love all of those things. It's available from Paraclete Press. Dr. Reese, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Gosh, it went fast, but we had fun. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You can multitask on our website. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. And that's important because you can listen anytime, anywhere. And we want you to share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. In other words, help us nurture a conversation in this nation about the issues we are discussing right here on State of Belief. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line. Oh, by the way, to make it easier for you to get in touch, we've just added a toll-free listener line. So go ahead, make a note of it right now. Here's the number, 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show, encourage them to listen to, make suggestions to us and to them that we might all carry on an important conversation characterized by civility aimed at more clarity. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man, you see.